This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training. For more, check out our website at adst.org. ADST, American Diplomacy, warts and all. In today's podcast, we'll hear from three people who experienced witchcraft and local superstitions while abroad with the State Department and the Peace Corps. First, we'll hear from John Helbel, who was a political officer stationed in Kuala Lumpur from 1969 to 1973. His experience begins when his cook becomes ill.
A week after we got to the new house, she got sick, and it seemed to be bronchial and a little fever and so on. Ultimately, she determined that in cleaning her room on arrival, she had touched a little glass bowl that had some ashes in it. And she had now concluded that those ashes were a talisman that had been burned by the previous inhabitant of the house, who was a Malay servant of that room, a Malay servant, who had not wanted to leave the house, and when obliged to leave because the family she was serving was leaving, she had sought assistance of a Malay Bomo, which is something like a witch doctor, crudely described as a witch doctor, perhaps, but in any event, sought his assistance to ensure that she could, in fact, stay at the house. And he had allegedly given her this talisman to burn, and that this would help her stay in the house. Of course, it didn't have the desired effect from her point of view, but the Chinese cook felt that she had been contaminated by this, and it was causing her to be ill. Several weeks this persisted, and I thought it was all a joke. But one day I came home, and Joan said they left, and they said they'll never come back because this is a bad place now. So I really bemoaned the loss of two extremely good members of the household staff, and particularly that marvelous cook. But there was not to be done. We offered them more money, and they said that has nothing to do with it. So we hired some replacement cook, and that cook became sick within a week or so. We then had the water checked. We had various inspections. But the second cook left. A third one was hired, lasted 3 days or so, left. And then we ran into really a dry hole. We couldn't find anybody who would work for us.
The word had gone out.
The word had gone out on the bamboo telegraph. It was a bad house here. And we had literally people come in for an interview. Joan would sit down with them, start to talk to them. They hadn't discussed wages or anything of that sort. Joan would notice that the interviewer or the interviewee would become flushed and start to perspire on her forehead, so on, and then on several occasions just got up and said, I can't work here, and dash off. Well, it was clear that we had a problem by this stage. Meanwhile, I had a fairly heavy representational responsibility for hosting dinners and parties and so on, and we had to suspend all of that activity, and therefore the issue became a matter of concern for the country team, and it was discussed on more than one occasion that the country team, with the ambassador, saying we've got to do something, we have to move you to another house or something. And we had to hire some staff. And eventually a couple came along, and the man was the cook, and he said, oh, I know all about that story. That's targeted against female cooks only. It won't affect me. Well, he was a lousy cook. She was a very harsh taskmaster, keeping the house clean and directing the kids and so on. But they were there. So we lived with it. We kept them because we couldn't get anything else. And they were there until we left, except that about 5 months before we left, the cook got off a bus at the Central Market, stepped on a banana peel, and broke his hip. But the other thing that I haven't said is that we have an exorcism done by CC2, T-O-O, who was the director of psychological warfare planning in the Ministry of Interior. He'd been trained by the British in the war against the communist guerrillas, and a very clever fellow and allowed by most to have extraordinary powers. And when he heard the story one night at a dinner at the ambassador's, he said, "I have to come over and do a job on your house." Well, I thought it was a joke again, and my wife said, "We're going to try it." So the next day, she called me for CC2's office number. He was over there within an hour that afternoon, explained what he was going to do. He said, Joan called me back at the office, said, he's going to come over at 7 o'clock. He says, invite any friends that you want, and they can witness this. So we lined up a dozen friends who were on the spur of the moment, all of whom knew about the problem. Came over, we sat down, and he went in to explain to the group that he was going, he was convinced that this was an evil force, not a ghost, but an evil force. And the question was whether his powers were greater than the Bono's powers who had brought the evil force upon the house. So he went into what I can only describe as a period of deep concentration, not quite a trance. He had told us we could keep talking and so on. Sat there on our veranda. And after about 45 minutes, he said, "I have made contact with the evil force, and it is, no question, a force. It is not a ghost." But he said, "Now I have to demonstrate to the force that I have greater powers than he who controls the force, and I have to repel it." So he went on this way, and about a little after 9 o'clock, the state of the, he had succeeded in repelling the force from the house. It was no longer there. He could not be certain how long it would stay away. It could return. It could return in 3 days, maybe 3 months, maybe never return. He couldn't tell that. But if it returned, you know, we should contact him. Get him from right back. At this point, we had two young girls who had just started working for us a few days before and who were going to leave that day when Joan convinced them that no, we have a very strong man coming to take care of this problem. So they decided they would wait through the course of the evening. They watched the whole thing from a distance, about 40 feet away from the kitchen door. And he watched it. After it was over, he went over to them. He explained to them what he had done. He explained to them that it was all right. Then he went next door to a companion house where another American officer lived. Got their servants out of their quarters and explained to them what had happened and what how this was now free. Here was the Cy War expert getting the word out on a bamboo telegraph as to what had happened. In any event, after about 2 weeks, the two girls decided to leave, and it was a little after that when finally we got this elderly couple, the poor gentleman with the banana peel, and that was it for the next 2 years. But it was quite an episode and quite the talk of town. And everybody said, "Well, CC2 did it again, you know." So anyway, it was an interesting experience. I'd never seen an exorcism, but that's what it was.
And next, we'll hear from Dorothy Robinson Kidder, who was a Foreign Service wife from 1938 through 1968. Her husband was an ambassador, and she served in such locations as Montreal, Paris, Sydney, Cambodia, Rio de Janeiro, and many more. She has two stories to tell. One involves her daughter Charlotte and an angry cook, and the other involves an exorcism in Rio de Janeiro.
And in Benin, where we had our first experience with black magic, and that was really very difficult, very difficult. Where will I begin it? Well, Charlotte was by that time, Mike was 5 and Charlotte was 3. And Charlotte, and we lived in the most extraordinary house, which had belonged to two German ladies who had run a school. The two ladies had been interned, not interred, but interned. One had been interred and the other had been was out from being interned. And she became our governess. Her name was Donna Ruth, and she was a remarkable German lady with a great sort of sensitivity. She was a remarkable person, and we were extraordinarily lucky to have her, and also because she helped a great deal in interpreting to us what Beling life was. Well, anyway, Charlotte began to be strangely ill. She was, and she got more and more ill. But, oh, I'm sorry, I should. Situation developed, which was unfortunate to say the least. Charlotte began, well, no, so I get there. I didn't get on with Randy's cook, whose name was Idalia, made the mistake of firing Idalia. Also made the mistake of firing her and going out right afterwards, not realizing that after I had gone, imprecations by Idalia were made throughout the house, that she was going to put a hex on us, that we would know that Idalia was working against us. And strangely enough, before long, it began to happen. I knew nothing of it. Nobody said anything to me about Idalia's imprecations. And Charlotte became sickly, but really quite sickly, feverish, and we had addressed ourselves to the medical unit of the Val-de-Cance, which was a wartime unit of ours, which saw about planes flying down to cross over to Asunción and then go on over to Dakar. And there was a unit there, which was an Air Force unit in Billing. And then there was also the Rubber Development Corporation had a medical unit, and we addressed ourselves to a nurse there. And nobody could diagnose this strange fever that Charlotte had. And one afternoon, she and I were lying on the bed, to my husband in my bed, my husband having gone back to the office. And literally, it was like holding a little bird's hand, a little claw, and it was really a terrible sensation. And I remember I was in a dressing gown, a sort of a piqué dressing gown. I'd see it all my life. And there was a long drive leading down to straight sort of path, bordered with perfectly horrible zinnias. I could never see zinnias, no matter what they're like, because they grow
they just
rust.
Flourish there.
You know, they grow rusty at the bottom, the thing that does, and they grow rusty at the bottom. Well, the bell rang at the gate, and the garden boy, Pedro, went down to open the door, open the gate, door, big swinging door. And then I saw him try to push it shut again. And I thought, I wondered what happened. And then the door would burst open again, and up the drive, folded over with Pedro behind the fold, and up the drive came this woman. Indian-looking woman, Indian Negroid, with a kind of insolent evil. You could just feel it in the walk. You know that picture which is called High Yalla? Well, that's exactly what this woman was like. And she clapped her hands, which you remember was a way of asking for entrance, and it was heeded, And then I heard the little maid downstairs calling up Donna Ruth, trying to call quietly so as not to disturb Charlotte and me. And Donna Ruth went downstairs, and then she came up in a few minutes, and she looked very drawn. And she said, that woman was applying for the position of cook. And she said, and while I was talking to her, it was very strange. Erminia, who was the laundress, came from the laundry, and she stood at the back window, and Teresa, who was the little maid, didn't leave the door leading into the room into which where I was sitting, talking to this woman. And just as she said that, we heard Pedro, the garden boy who had opened the door, who never spoke, calling with great anxiety in his voice, Donna Ruth, Donna Ruth. Meanwhile, I had seen this woman leave. Donna Ruth came down the stairs and came back up in a minute and said, you know, this is it. This is really very serious. That was Pedro asking me, you didn't keep her, did you? No, said Donna Ruth, we didn't. Oh, said Pedro. She said, she is such bad news. She comes from the island of Marajo, and she is a witch. And she is sent by Idalia, who feels that the imprecations are going too slowly. And she was to enter our service and accelerate it. And Donna Ruth turned to me, and she said, you know, Mrs. Kidder, this is what you are going to have the place exorcised. Because if you don't, everything is going to wither around you. The rest of the staff will leave, and nobody will serve you in market, and you will just be a pariah. And I said, well, Donna Ruth, I can't do that. As you know, I mean, the authorities don't recognize black magic. And how can we go along with this? And she said, well, I don't know what to do, but I suggest that you call Mrs. McCrae. Well, Mrs. McCrae is a wonderful lady, Nora McCrae. She was the wife of an official, a British official, who was in the streetcar business. You remember the British started the Bondies, and they were called Bondies mm-hmm. because of a bond that was floated to start the streetcar. And Ken McCrae had lived in Billings something like 35 years. And dear Nora McCrae was, oh, she was such a help and a counsel in every way. And I went downstairs, I can remember it, trying to get my hand out of this Charlotte's very hot little hand. Going downstairs, the telephone was on the wall. That the telephones in Belang very rarely worked because they were activated by electricity, which was activated by wood, and as it rained all the time, there was very few sparks. Well, that day, fortunately, that afternoon, there was one. And I woke Nora McCrae, which is a thing you never did, from siesta, and told her what had happened. And she said, yes, darling, this is very, very serious. You have to have the place exorcised, or you have to have some semblance of exorcism. Something has to happen. And I thought, well, Nora, I don't know what it can be. I don't know what it can be. Because Randy can't lend himself to this situation. Well, Nora said, I don't know, but think about it. And an idea came. Our property backed up on a property of a monastery. And the monks had very much hoped to entice Mike to be one of their pupils in a kind of daycare thing that they ran. And to do so, which would have been in competition of what I was trying to do in the barn behind the house with Calvert system. But they did not desist, and they would frequently invite Mike over the fence by putting a ladder on his side and a ladder on our side, and Mike would go up and he'd see all the kinds of interesting things that they had over there, like animals of one kind or another. And it suddenly occurred to me that this was our one chance that Mike could invite them to come and see our animals. And we did have some chickens, and we did have a turtle tank, and a few rabbits, and probably enough to interest the monks anyway from the curiosity of wanting to see how we lived. So that was planned for a certain Sunday, late Sunday morning. And I kept all the staff in. And we pulled up the ladder and we ceremoniously invited them over. And Mike arranged with Mike how they would walk by the pen in which the rabbits were, and the pen in which the chickens were, and by the turtle tank, and underneath the avocado tree, and right through the center of the house, and then back into the barn, where our school, our sort of schoolhouse barn was, where they would be offered a collation. And I remember my heart in my mouth as I watched them go back up over the up the ladder, over the wall, down the other side, at which moment, with Mike waving, we all waving, saying goodbye, and the staff standing around looking really very impressed. There was no holy water scattered, there were no prayers made, but just this presence. And then we let the staff out. And the next day, we had a very nice person present herself as cook, and Charlotte's fever receded. Well, having gotten that close to what it meant, then when we went to Rio and we had this possibility of studying white magic with Joãozinho Pai dos Santos, who came from Bahia, the center of the Candomblé, I did study with him and became, well, I became a white magic priestess of the second degree. We had, when it happened to us in Rio, it didn't happen to me in Rio, but I got called into being part of an exorcism in Rio, of a absolutely beautiful Rio girl. But do you want more of that on this, or should we move on to something
please
else?
Please go ahead. I think this is part of Foreign Service life. And that's what we're recording. So, I mean, it was part of your life, and it was definitely
certainly
part
was.
Of mine.
Well, part of yours, the seven accidents. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, this story had to do with her name was Branca Melo Franco Alves, which is actually, she was related to the then, or not then, shortly after ambassador to Washington, who was a great friend of Elsie Lyons and a great friend of ours, whose name was Mauricio Nabucco. Do you remember Mauricio Nabucco by any chance? Those were the years, let me see, we left Berlin, and they were years 50 to 53.
That he was. We were there 26 years later.
Oh, right. Well, Mauricio had gone back a long time from when he was a very successful Brazilian ambassador. This girl was very high born and perfectly beautiful. God, she was beautiful. And I will say that she did have a husband, he's now dead, who was quite a coureur. I think that possibly this is the root of the problem. But anyway, the problem was that she suddenly began to develop a strange allergy. And this beautiful face, the lips swole, and there were sort of great plaques of red, itchy red things all over her body and her face. It was almost like an attack of shingles. And she went to the dermatologist, and all the dermatologists tried all kinds of different things, and nothing for it. So she began to think, well, maybe something is happening. She was a Brazilian girl. And so she addressed herself to her cook. I'm sorry, it's the other way around. Her cook. And it took pity on this frantic effort to see how this thing could be cured, and came to her and she said, "Madame, I think I know what's happening. And if you will afford me time off, I will go back to San Cristóvão, which was a bairro, a surrounding area which was known for magic of both varieties. And she said, I will try and ferret out what's happening." And she came back a day or so later and said that she had found the way, she thought she knew the source, and she also thought she knew how to combat the problem. And that she would send her a priestess, just as you would receive. And that she, Branca, would require four witnesses. Well, Branca knew what we'd been through and knew what our interest was in it, and so she asked me to be one. And then she had three other Brazilian friends, all pretty sophisticated girls. And the meeting was to be at 2:00 in the afternoon, And it was in a very, how will I say it? I guess the word is sophisticated area of Brazil, of Rio. Beyond Copacabana, it was in... Exactly, mm-hmm. Ipanema. Were you also in Rio?
Well, of course we were in Rio, but yeah, not posted right. there.
It was in Ipanema, it was on the beach, it was Vieira Soto, and we lived in Anibal de Mendonça, about four blocks behind. So we were all in the same area, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and everything was perfectly normal. And I went to the meet with the others, and we waited with Branca's cook, and poor Branca completely disfigured, and the other three girls and myself, frightfully nervous, not knowing what was going to be happening. And eventually there was a clap at the door, and the door was opened by the cook, and in came Dona Dora. Now Dona Dora looked as though she might be 35. She was very trimly dressed in a white skirt. She did have a baiana, short white skirt. She had a baiana blouse, but not an extravagant, ruffly one. It was and very attractively pressed, and she looked very simple and very attractive. If you met her down the street, you wouldn't have any idea. And with her was a somewhat older, heavier woman. And the cook introduced not them to Branca, but Branca to them, and the rest of us. And the acolyte, the heavier woman, asked if she might go off into another room. She asked, Dona Dora asked if she might go and change, which she did, and left the acolyte telling us that what was going to be needed would be a glass full of cachaça, on which a crucifix was then laid with a rosary that curled around the glass, and that she would need an empty orange crate, which there was, for Dona Dora to sit on, not a stool, but an orange crate, and how we were to be disposed around the room, how we, the witnesses, had to take off all jewelry, how we had to sit on the floor with our legs extended and our arms extended so nothing would be crossed, nothing would impede the traveling of the spirits, and how Branca, who had wonderful black hair, a lot of it, had to take the hairpins out, how she had to be in her white slip, barefoot, and would stand before Dona Dora. Dona Dora came back in. She had on one of those baiana skirts and a more roughly blouse, but she still was extremely composed, and she was still 35 years old. And the lights, the Venetian blinds were pulled down, and the light was sort of slanting in this way. And Dona Dora sat on her crate, and Branca stood behind her, and we were on the floor, two on each side. And Dona Dora began a kind of an imprecation, that mixture, you know, what is the name of the language that they speak? I can't think at the moment. But it's the African conversion, it's the mixture of the African, and it's not Osh. Oh, I can't think at the moment, I'm sorry. But anyway.
Of course, the gods are called Oshira, aren't they?
Is it is something,
something like that.
Something very close
yes.
to that. And she,
I'll look it up in my book.
She begins the imprecation, which is a mixture of the Lord's Prayer and the invitation to the gods and so on, and it becomes more and more accelerated. And as it does so, and I assure you, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and none of us had had anything to drink or anything other than our own nervousness and anxiety about this. And out of that figure that was 35 came a crone. I saw a crone.
Yeah, absolutely astonishing.
And you lived the same thing?
Yes.
It's true, isn't it?
Yes.
It's true.
Total change of...
The knuckles, the teeth, the gums, the voice, everything. As you know what it's like, I won't go into it in yeah. endless detail.
And how they do it.
And how they do it, I don't know. And the passes to get rid of the evil out of Branca, and then a reversion to further prayer, and then out emerged dressed in a skirt, a man who was a young, virile man dressed in a skirt. with a kind of a strange sort of fury of evil, and he walked around that room and he grabbed each one of us to our feet, and I really felt that I was being held by something, in the grip of something really frightening, and allowed to drop back down again as he moved about. And by that time the acolyte had asked for an ironing board, just the flat top of an ironing board, and told Branca to stand on the ironing board. And by that time the light was such that it was coming directly down onto the ironing board, almost like stabbing it. And there was Branca with the black hair, the white slip, and this capering creature who was pacing on all four sides, emptying little bags, which turned out to be gunpowder, and then lighting them. And they went off with poof and broom and smoke. And there, and it was by that time maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this capering, really evil kind of creature, fiend, exactly. And then he returned to a very hysterical kind of a prayer, and out of him returned our little old woman, absolutely drained. She was exhausted, and you could see that she was exhausted. And she then went around, almost, feebly around to all of us, talked to us. She told me, and now my Lord was I ever grateful, and the same thing happened once again. She said, "You will never know evil," which was just too wonderful. And the next person who told me that was Martin Buber. So I feel that maybe it's true.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. So far, so good. So so she returns to this. The crone, by the time that Donna Dora returned through yet another invocation, another prayer, very feebly enunciated, Donna Dora was just wrecked. She was just finished. She was just wobbly finished. Mm-hmm. Within 2 or 3 days, I will say that the old crone told us who had done this. Told us that was a Thursday that this thing was happening. Told us that on Sunday this person was going to suffer retribution.
And last, John Pielemeyer, a Peace Corps volunteer who taught in Côte d'Ivoire from 1966 through 1968.
Well, this is an interview with John, the middle mission?
Daniel.
John Daniel Pielemeyer, who... And the date is September 24th, 1997. When did you start with AID?
I guess I joined AID in 1970, the very last part of 1970.
How many years altogether?
24 plus. Thinking about what I was going to do after undergraduate school and essentially discussing it, and it just became very clear that Peace Corps was the way to go. I, of course, wanted to go back to use my languages, my one language that I had, Spanish, although I'd done a little bit of French. And in Peace Corps' traditional fashion, they did not send me to Latin America.
What year was this we're talking about?
This would be in 1966. They sent me to the Ivory Coast. So I was assigned to a school in the sort of central north of the Ivory Coast, in a town called Kachiola. And it was run by, basically at that time in the Ivory Coast, there were very few trained Ivorians, even to teach high school. And so mostly expatriates were there, a lot of French volontaires, people doing their military service teaching in secondary schools in Africa. Some British volunteers, I was the only Peace Corps volunteer in the school. I was exploring around when I was there also. I traveled to East Africa during one summer and hitchhiked around Kenya and Tanzania, tried to go to Zanzibar, but it was off limits. So I got to see a little more of Africa, which also was intriguing to me. And then in the last year that I was teaching, the story goes, if you were one of my students, that that I went out to the sacred forest without the permission of the witch doctor, which is true, in fact. I did go out to the sacred forest with a guy who ran a little African restaurant. He wanted to show me some stuff. The stories were that you had little gremlins that came up and blocked the bulldozers that the French brought in, so that the bulldozers couldn't push a road through the sacred forest. They broke the plow heads of the of these big machines, according to the Ivoirians. But the sacred forest was there, and we visited it, and it was probably a month or two later when, by chance, I came down with a paralysis. And at the end of the school, year just before Christmas, and had to, in the middle of the night, get myself down to try to see a Peace Corps doctor 6 or 8 hours away, and eventually it was clear it was a paralysis that wasn't going to go away. So I had to be medevaced from the Ivory Coast and never saw my students again, and so I was told by my teachers later that the story flourished that I was paralyzed because I'd gone to the sacred forest without the permission of the witch doctor.
ADST is an independent nonprofit organization located in Arlington, Virginia. ADST's oral history collection, begun in 1986, contains over 2,500 oral histories, unveiling the horrifying, thought-provoking, and the absurd events that helped shape foreign policy. If you have enjoyed listening to this podcast, please make a tax-deductible donation to allow ADST to continue its work at www.adst.org.